Hi, my name is Jason Harris, and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production by Neural, an agency that helps both brands and talent tell their story. To learn more, just visit neural.com. That's NERALLE.com. My guest this week, Jason Harris, co-founder and CEO of Mechanism and author of The Soulful Art of Persuasion. I was leaning on Brendan for some inside jokes. And I hear you've got this shoe addiction.
I do, yeah.
Tell us about that.
I can't stop buying sneakers.
Okay.
And I have a whole closet in my apartment that's just sneakers, most of which I've never worn.
Okay.
I'm always scouring StockX for different kinds of shoes.
Oh, yeah.
And if I see one, they're like artwork, and I just want to have it, even if it's not very functional or I don't need the pair. And so I almost keep them in a closet and look at how pretty they are.
That's so funny.
It's not great.
How many pairs would you have today?
I recently did a purge, but I probably have like 115, something like that.
Do you mainly flip them on things like StockX and other platforms?
Nah, I don't even make money off them.
Really?
I'll give them to people in my office if I'm kind of done with them.
Okay. So yeah, you remind me then of a founder here locally, a big independent agency like Mechanism. The headcount's probably a little bit smaller, but he's got this obsession with sneakers as well. I don't know how big his collection is. I feel like he's got 200 pairs.
Yeah, that's probably right.
But it's significant.
But I have a New York apartment, so I have to like keep purging them because there's only so much room. But to me, I don't know. They make me happy. But I'm just glad I don't have like a car addiction or a furniture addiction. You know, at least shoes are not crazy expensive.
Well, why shoes? Why do you think that is? Is that something that you grew up with?
You know, it probably has to do with like design and marketing, and you know, I'm pretty much only buy Nikes.
Okay.
But I love the brand and what it represents, and they're always coming out with new styles. And I think it's partly brand love, and partly I like mixing up shoes and, you know, I pretty much wear black, like a lot of New Yorkers. And so the only pop of color comes on my feet. So I'm always, you know, wearing pink shoes, red shoes, you name it, whatever to give it a little pop, little edge.
Let's jump a little bit south to Virginia. So you were born, I remember in, I think it was Fairfax, Virginia. Did you spend much of what's sort of your earliest inception memory of your childhood?
That's a good question. It's sort of a blur. Like I don't have like that one thing that pops out, but I played, I always played soccer growing up.
Okay.
And so I coach my kids' soccer teams. That's sort of the memory I always remember back from Virginia, just every weekend playing soccer.
Okay.
Since I was like a little kid.
That was the team, it was like the local team, a big thing?
Kinda. Virginia was more like Texas. It's like football kind of was the sport.
Yeah. So it was sort of, it was unusual, so to speak, to be playing soccer there.
Not unusual, but it wasn't drawing massive crowds, I'll put it that way. Yeah.
What did you think you were going to be when you were a kid?
I always thought, you know, when I was younger, I always loved the way, you know, different, because Fairfax, Virginia is near DC, and I'd go to the city a lot, and I always loved going to museums and looking at the different monuments and how they were built. And I thought I'd be like an architect or an engineer. I always loved studying and looking at buildings.
Interesting.
But then pretty early on, I pivoted, you know, way before high school, like maybe entering high school. And I was a TV addict, so I love watching TV. And I'd always study those interstitials, those commercials in between the shows. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, somebody's selling these brands and these companies. And that seems cool. Like, it seems like kind of fun. So I kind of pivoted, and then really through high school and then college, I just knew that's what the field I was going to go into, which is unusual. But I kind of knew it early on.
Yeah. I think at that age, it is unusual to think about advertising unless you have family in that area. Like, I know I was reading that you had that interest in watching ads. And specifically, I think it was Lego My Ego and the Kool-Aid ad.
Do you know those ads?
Yeah, yeah. The Kool-Aid ad is pretty well. It's like a universal thing, right?
It is? Okay, yeah. He was just like smashed through like a high school dance. And
oh, yeah. Like his,
yeah, oh, yeah. And the sugar water would be spilling out of his head. And all the kids would be psyched and all the parents would be grumpy. They'd be pissed. You know, this guy just destroyed my wall.
Well, it's so universal that like the Family Guy bit. Have you seen the Family Guy bit where Kool-Aid Man just runs through like a courtroom? He's like, oh, yeah.
No way. That's amazing. I have not seen that. I'm going to look that up.
Yeah, just search Kool-Aid Family Guy. It's fucking hilarious.
Did you grow up in Melbourne?
Yeah, I grew up in Melbourne. Yeah, but my family, they weren't in advertising, but they were always in... like my dad's a fourth generation printer. So we were always like obsessed with media, so to speak. Like my favorite thing as a kid, having gotten into this space now in hindsight, it sort of seems quite obvious. But my favorite thing was my grandfather, Greek immigrant, never paid for any movie, just recorded it on TV. So he had like a wall of movies. So like, and there was a heavy British influence. So we'd watch things like Fawlty Towers, and then he'd record all the Disney films and all these different shows. But my favorite bit was the ads in between.
That's awesome. That's here with me.
Yeah. So I still kept a lot of those videos just for the old ads. Like what's one of my favorite ones? Like the Snappy Tom ad. I don't know if Snappy Tom was like a real food here. It's like the cats of Australia made their choice. And it's like this whole, they made this whole ecosystem out of this song. And then there was, I think it was Alka-Seltzer. The guy who's got like heartburn, he's like, that's a spicy meatball.
That's a spicy meatball. Yeah. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is.
Yeah. There was the John West ads. They were big here. I don't know if John West was a thing in, it was big in Canada and Australia, but it's like a tuna brand. And the guy would go fight bears for like salmon and tuna and stuff like that, like in the river. It's fucking hilarious.
No way. Yeah. What a stud.
It's a very good ad. Anyway, what did your parents like do when you were growing up?
They were both in academia, so they were teachers.
Okay.
And they were always reading. You know, my house was like full of readers. Me, not so much. You know, I wrote a book, so I'm into reading now. I got into reading, you know, when I was an adult. But as a kid, I just wanted to like go explore and have experiences. And my parents were much more homebodies and intellectuals, and we're like polar opposites in that way. But they, you know, they were not watching TV or checking out the commercials at all. I was down reading. In the basement doing that. Yeah. They're reading.
When you look at cause we all have this, right, where we see things in our parents that we sort of shudder at, like, you know, we've got that certain tick or that certain saying or, this way of doing things. For me, it was always, you know, I picked it up from my dad, this principle of hard work, just indirectly through watching him. It's almost like an addictive thing. Which the double-edged sword is that you can't relax. So while it's a good trait to have, it's also a negative trait. And you see that in your dad. So was there things that you had growing up that now you realize you have that you've picked up from your parents?
I sort of went the other way where I was like, I'm going to do the opposite of what they do.
Yeah.
Like instead of marrying my parents, I really like pushed against my parents. So they weren't great with money. Right. Okay. So finances were sometimes an issue. And so I just remember being like that. I'm going to make sure that's never an issue for me. Like
Okay.
I'm not going to be like that. I'm going to invest when I'm young, you know, try to make sure I'm stable and not have the worries that they had. So I sort of pushed against some of the things that stood out for me. I'm going to travel. They don't love traveling. I'm always going to travel. And so I sort of, like you, maybe you got some traits from your parents. I sort of went the other way and pushed against some of the things that I saw around me.
Yeah.
That said, they had really great moral compass. They would always do the right thing. You know, they're like the kind of people that after a movie, if there was trash in their row, they'd pick it up. Like if other people left trash, you know, everyone just in America, you go to a movie, you leave all your stuff.
Yeah.
People like shit. someone's going to clean it up.
Yeah.
You know, they would always do that. They would always tell the truth. They don't drink. They don't smoke. They don't, you know, they're like their moral compass for doing the right thing is super strong. And so that's one trait I try as much as I can to, well, not that I don't drink, of course I drink, but that I try to emulate is they were always grounded in make the right choice. And that's something that definitely stood with me.
Yeah. So they're quite civic. That makes sense. That explains why you've gotten involved in sort of the political sphere is that civic mindedness.
Yeah, definitely. And growing up in DC area, you know, outside of DC in Virginia.
Yeah.
It's sort of like if you live in LA, the dominating industry is like entertainment.
Mm.
So everyone's talking about entertainment. And outside of DC and like the Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, DC area.
Yeah.
Politics is like the driving theme.
Well, how far is Fairfax from the district?
I think it's like maybe like 18 miles, 15 miles, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's not far at all.
No, it's not that far.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. A lot of sense.
But the other thing I did, one last thing, because I love this conversation about do we emulate or go against our parents? My parents were not into sports at all, right? Okay. And so when I had kids, like my entire weekend is dominated by shepherding my kids back and forth to sports. And or if they're in like a rec league, something that I could coach because it's not like a select league or a travel league. They have far better coaches that do that for them.
Right.
But if there's anything I can coach, I'm always going to coach and I'm always going to, it's like a priority on my weekends is sports where they had no interest. Like they, a lot of times they wouldn't go to my events. They do something else.
Really? So
it sounds like I have terrible parents, but they're awesome. But I just remember thinking like, well, my kids are going to be, I'm going to every game. They're going to play sports all weekend. You know, they're going to play more than one sport and I'm like all in on it.
Do you know what's funny about that is your kids will probably grow up and be like, I don't want to ever have anything to do with sport.
They're like, I'm totally burnt out on sports. Like,
yeah.
My kids don't have to play sports. Yeah.
So what do they like? Your kids obviously play soccer. You mentioned what else do they play?
Baseball.
Okay. Baseball is big in New York.
And then they run track.
Okay. And any particular
is baseball that big there? I know it's obviously like Australian rules and then there's cricket and I know there's and rugby, but is baseball have any popularity there?
I mean, US sports, like our religion here in Australia is sport. So if you can't consume AFL, if you can't consume cricket or soccer or rugby, you're watching some other sort of sport. And because everyone's got, you know, cable here essentially, and our system is Foxtel, which is, you know, former Fox system.
Okay.
You basically watch everything. So you've got ESPN, you've got everything. So everyone watches. If I were to rank it, I would say it's basketball, probably your football. What is it? NFL?
Yep.
Then it's a hard split one between baseball and hockey. Like hockey's one of those creeper sports.
Yeah.
I remember there was a hockey rink around the corner from me growing up that was quite big. But, you know, I definitely think basketball is the number one sport here by far. They're trying to rep.
So do people watch the NBA finals
that are on right now? They're obsessed with it. I mean, we knew that COVID was real because the NBA was basically canceled because of COVID. And we had not kicked off our major seasons for AFL or rugby as yet. And so over here, that our main system, which is the AFL, they were like, shit, this is like really serious. How are we going to do this? Yeah. How are we going to do this? And yeah.
It's so interesting because like you guys basically wake up and watch basketball, right? Because it's on like our evening. So it's like a morning thing, which is crazy to think about.
Yeah, I have mates that I used to work with that, you know, I don't have this pleasure of doing it, that, you know, they're working for someone, they're working from home, they're sitting there typing on the keyboard and just on the TV working from home, they've got the NBA on.
That's awesome. That's crazy to know. I went to, I went to Melbourne. I loved, I had the absolute best time there.
What year?
I think it was, must have been last year. Must have been right before.
What, yeah. 2020?
I think so. It was either that or the end of 2019.
And what were you here for?
There's an event called Advertising Week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's like where that amusement park is.
In which city?
It's in Sydney.
At Luna Park?
Luna Park, yeah, that's what it was, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a Luna Park in Sydney and Melbourne. Okay, so you went to both Sydney and Melbourne.
I went to and then like maybe 8 years earlier, I went to the Melbourne Comedy Festival.
The MIF, yeah.
It was unbelievable, but we went there because we were working. This is pretty early on when we started the agency. We were working on a project with a comedian, Dimitri Martin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And we were trying to convince him to work with us on a project for Microsoft.
Okay.
And it was called Clarification, the project we ended up doing. But he had our project with Microsoft, and then he also had on the table being remember the Apple PC commercials?
Yeah.
I'm an Apple, I'm a PC.
Yeah,
he was going to be that Apple guy for those commercials.
No shit.
So he was trying to decide. Yeah, he was trying to decide between doing Apple or doing Microsoft. And so we needed this project. We were like kind of running on fumes because we were fairly new, and we had this massive project like on the hook. But we needed Dimitri Martin because that's the guy that we pushed.
Okay,
you know, that's how we pitched it, and we flew. I was in San Francisco at the time. We flew from San Francisco to Melbourne, my partner and I, and hung out with Dimitri Martin in between. He was doing the comedy festival circuit, and befriended him and convinced him to go with our project instead of becoming the Apple guy.
So I have this note here for Brendan to ask about a really early pivotal campaign like Clarification.
Yeah, that was it.
That's so funny.
And so, in Melbourne, we just basically like hunted down Dimitri Martin but in between we went to other comedy shows all over Melbourne, and it was, that festival is so unique.
Yeah. That festival was wild, man. We're so lucky to have that here.
It's like nothing else. There's nothing else like that in the world, really.
So it's big in the Commonwealth countries to have those big, big comedy festivals. Whereas in the US, like if you're a comedian, you go and do a special, right? Or you do a tour and people see you. And I'm lucky enough. I went to the Edinburgh Fringe, is probably the next biggest one in comparison to Melbourne or the MIF. And Melbourne is still bigger and better, I would say, just in terms of the amount of people that are there. There's a lot of US comedians to make as well.
There might be other festivals, but every show is packed. It's like a rock concert. Like embracing comedy like that. I don't know if it's because people are starved for it there, or if they, that's just like a way of life is, you know, NBA comedy, you know, yeah. I don't know if that's how it goes. Yeah,
that's that. Look, there's a cultural thing about Australia. I don't know if you picked it up, but we're very egalitarian and against hierarchy. And yeah. So comedy is just intertwined in everyday life. It's like a challenging aspect. Like no one trusts authority here. And so comedy is so good for that. It's so cathartic because people just go in and just rag on politicians or leaders or whatever it may be. And it's just all about the common man, so to speak. But that typifies that. Australia.
Yeah, I love that. That's great.
So what was your, I'm always interested because one of my favorite things to do is see what Americans think about Australia. What was your impression when you came here?
A lot of very attractive people.
Okay.
I'd say for the most part, like super warm.
Yep.
I don't know if that jives with what you think. And then super heavy drinkers.
Yeah. Big drinkers. It's definitely warmer like, than the US.
Like just, yeah, I felt like you could, you know, talk to someone at a bar.
Yeah.
And they talk back to you and, you know, you'd have a conversation. And then, you know, Sydney is super healthy.
Yeah, very healthy.
You know, it's different, but it's like everyone's, you know, eating bowls of vegetables and running on the beach. And
it's like LA. You know, do you think it's like LA a bit?
It is a lot like LA, yeah.
Yeah, it's very pretentious, like in comparison to Melbourne.
Yeah, Melbourne is more, it's more laid back.
Yeah.
It has a little bit of a, more of a New York vibe, yeah. I'd say.
I think and the best like analogy is like, it's sort of like San Fran. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd say it's like San Francisco. Definitely.
Yeah. Cause you got the cold. It gets fucking cold here. So you would have been here in April. What a time to be in Australia. It's sort of one of the best times I reckon. Autumn.
You're like, so it's winter now. What's the weather like?
I mean, it's cold for us. It was about 2 degrees overnight, but for you guys, that's probably like a warm winter's night, right? So yeah. 2 degrees Celsius. So what's that? 2 degrees. I'm terrible at this Fahrenheit thing. Celsius to Fahrenheit. So it was 35 degrees.
35 degrees. Yeah. Yeah. That's yeah. What I was gonna say. The only time I ran into any trouble in Australia was in Sydney. You know, we went to Bondi.
Oh yeah.
And swam in the iceberg.
No. Right.
And then, have you ever been there and done that?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, of course you have. And then there's a sauna that you get warmed up in afterwards.
Yeah.
And I was holding the door open for my partner, and I got screamed at by like 10 Australians that were in the sauna. And that's the only time I was like, oh, wow, they could kind of get ornery.
Yeah, yeah.
They were saying like, what the fuck? You know, they're like, what the fuck are you doing? You know, like.
They're probably like, shut the fucking door, mate.
Yeah, shut the fucking door. What are you doing? Yeah. And he started screaming at me. I was like, oh, man, I thought I was like popular here. I thought people liked me, but.
Yeah. No, we love it. Yeah. We love Americans, but I think like it's a bit of a, it's a bit harsh sometimes when like you would see that scenario as like a really like ramped up scenario in the States, but here, like that's just normal. Like the next moment you could be having a beer with those people and it's all fine.
Oh yeah. No, we're way more passive aggressive. It's like we have like undertones. We'll say things that sound, you're like, how do I interpret that? Like,
yeah.
You know, was he being a dick or was he like, you know?
So like, well, I've had friends who work in the US and culturally it's just the match is not there. Like as in, I have this one friend, Ben, he was working in New York and he was in this office and because we're all just shit stirrers, right? And so it's this guy that he got given this nickname because he had like these shoes or something like that. And I don't know. Let's say his nickname was Smokey. And he just kept calling him. He'd be like, Smokes. Hey, Smokey, can I grab that pen? And he just like do it on purpose, like all day long.
Oh, my God, it's so funny.
And so like in Australia, that's standard. Like it's just funny. And groups of men are notorious for doing that. But this guy, who got this nickname Smokey, just flipped. He turned around and he's like, excuse me, can you stop calling me Smokey? And like, he just went off, and the whole office was dead quiet. Like, we're talking about 50, 60 people.
And oh my God.
He's a real like straight shooter American type. He's got like the buzz cut sort of army haircut. Yeah.
He's supposed to go along with it and then give it back. Right.
Yeah. You meant to give it back. You're like, yeah, shut up. Anyway. Yeah.
Well, all the other thing about Australians, cause I hired an Australian woman who helps manage our New York office, and she's awesome. They will just keep hiring more Australians.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That, it's almost like they get in and they're like, oh, it's pretty good here.
Yeah.
I'm going to make sure I hire as many fucking Australians as I can.
Yeah. Yeah.
They look out for each other.
Gordon Ramsay's got a whole bit about that. Like, about ragging on Australians who just come in to like his restaurant, and then all of a sudden one of the sous chefs he hires is Australian, and then all of a sudden there's five or six of them, and he's like,
yeah, it's unreal.
That's so funny. Yeah, because we all travel, and when we find something good in a certain place, we all just gravitate towards it.
I kind of love that though. It's like a real I'll get your back mentality.
Yeah,
I'm gonna start calling her Smokey too, by the way.
What's it? You probably don't want to disclose her name. You can email me afterwards. I'll give you a real shit-stirring name to give her.
Okay, good. And then she'll be like, oh, yeah, that sounds good.
So was that campaign for Mechanism, or was that back in the day when you were like a TBWA or
No, that was a Mechanism campaign.
Okay.
Early days. You know, now we got four offices with 200 people. We got 25 clients. Like, we're established.
Yeah,
it's good. But earlier days, there was like two or three times when like we almost completely went out of business, and we needed that one thing, that one job to like pull through last minute for us to keep going. And somehow it worked out. So we got lucky.
I'm sort of for my agency. We specialize in social and influence, and particularly like a sub-specialization in TikTok. I reckon we've just gotten past that phase as an agency where you're going from one meal to another, if that makes sense.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
It does make sense.
It was interesting looking at your background. I mean, you obviously studied economics, and then you'd sort of... Your story gives me a bit of hope because client, you're the client management new business guy, which is what I am. But you've become an early stage founder. You know, you're obviously a natural born salesman. And so I look back at that and I go, oh shit, okay, you can do that. You don't have to be some wild creative to be successful.
You need both, you know, and it's still whatever business you're running, you got to have business minded people to run it.
Yeah.
You know, you need that partnership. So, you know, quick background. I knew I wanted to go into advertising. I did study economics, but that was really to make my parents happy. And then as soon as I got out of school, I started working at agencies, in LA and eventually San Francisco, where we founded the agency. But I would always look at these different agencies, and I knew I was entrepreneurial. I wanted to start something eventually. But I would take what I saw from the leaders as good and bad and sort of keep track and, you know, take notes and what I would bring to a company that I had eventually. And so it was really a great training ground. But before Mechanism, I started a company by myself, and it was a production company. We were doing like branded content. We were doing like TV, which is kind of interesting, my background, because I like the ads in between the shows. Mm. This was pitching brands to do TV shows where the media company, the media platform would then sell ads against the TV shows, but the brand would pay to make the TV shows. So we did one with Adidas and Xbox. But I started that company first, and it was just me.
Right, so that was Plan C.
Yeah, that was Plan C. And it was just me doing the, you know, hiring the producers and directors and doing the invoicing and the pitching. Like, it was really, Just Me, I had a little bit of help with a friend of mine in Atlanta, but I burned out on that gig pretty quickly, like a year and a half. I don't know if you ever did anything on your own, but
it's hard.
It's really challenging, but you kind of want to, because you have that hard work gene, you're like, no, I can do it. Like, I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to start it my own. And then with Mechanism, having, you know, other partners, it's just so much more rewarding to do it with other people. Yeah. And, you know, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, you know, go together. I think that statement's so true.
Yeah.
Cause you just can't sustain it when you do things. I mean, maybe some people can, but I wasn't wired that way.
Yeah. You end up blowing a gasket pretty much.
You really do. Yeah. You're just because,
like I said, that hardworking ethos that you have, it also means that you can't recognize when you're about to blow a gasket. So it's only when you finally blow the gasket that you realize that it was too far.
The gasket has been blown.
It's interesting you mentioned about the economics thing, and like my dad, Greek family, is like, you've got to do a profession. So I did accounting and finance at uni. And like, I think I lasted a couple of years until I sort of got back into the sort of the media space.
Did you work in that field after?
Yeah. So I was like, I studied bank and finance, did an accounting internship, fucking hated it, went into sort of the trading desk space, loved that, like loved the environment, the sales environment, but it was so intense. It never, ever stopped because markets never stop. Like I could be up at 6 a.m. and up until 1 a.m. because the US Open was happening. So it was not tenable. And then I got into sort of sales, selling services to those people. And then I realized, because my now wife and co-founder of the business was working at PwC and a few independents like Taboo Group. She was a creative director. And we started this podcast and we were just like, maybe we should start selling these services to people. And it sort of just spun out from that.
And that's how it started?
That's how it started, yeah. So, you know, like what you were saying before about having someone to work with, I could not do what I do without her and vice versa.
That's amazing.
It's just not possible.
It's amazing that you guys can work together.
I know. That's a lot of people say that.
And you guys specialize, you do a lot with TikTok, right?
Yeah, a lot of TikTok. I mean, that's how I found Brendan. Brendan and I were chatting over TikTok.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, like TikTok here is fairly nascent, like it is in the US, but it's, social and influence, but TikTok is, I just want to be known as the TikTok guy over the next couple of years.
Well, that's going to serve you well.
Yeah.
Because it's definitely gaining ground on everything.
Oh, yeah. It's quite nuts to see like campaign returns. And so that's like, you know, you were saying before about just having that thing, like that Dimitri Martin campaign is like, you just needed it to keep things going. I feel like we've just gotten through that stage over the last couple of months that thing has been TikTok. Because without that, I don't know what, you know, there's so many areas that you can specialize in. I don't know what would have made us different otherwise. It's a hard field to define yourself. You know what I mean?
Totally. But having that expertise, everyone needs it.
You. Yes, you. Are you intrigued by this episode? If so, go to our footer on the website, neurallee.com. We're going to give you an insight each week. It's going to be on business, marketing, or a topic that we covered in the episode at all. We'd love your support and it would help us in developing the intellect around this series. But without going on too much longer, let's get back into this episode. What I was intrigued about for you guys is like, it's now, like you said, an award-winning, independent, full-service ad agency. You've got 230 staff. You've got these offices, I think, San Fran, New York, Chicago, Seattle. Yeah. All these wonderful clients, all these wonderful awards. You know, in hindsight, it's easy to say Solent Science today, but when did you realize that was your thing? And when did you realize it was significant enough in the market?
Well, we recently rolled that sort of new positioning out.
Yeah.
And we realized we wanted to stand for creativity and performance. So that's really what Soul and Science, that's our approach. But it's, you know, we really added performance. So like insight, research, measurement of the work, optimization. We added that group maybe a year ago. Right. And creative is always what we've done, strategy and creative. And we paired that together to say we're a, you know, an agency that does creativity and performance to build great brands and just keep the elevator pitch to that. And the way we do it is through Soul and Science. And I think prior to that, we would explain ourselves more as we can do strategy and creative and media buying and planning and production. And we have a social media arm. And so we were doing it more on services, mm-hmm. but not on what we offer. And I think, you know, it took us a while to develop that, but we realized we got to simplify what we offer. And then the way we do it in all the departments and all the services, it's kind of secondary.
Yeah.
And so that was a big switch for us to not think about, oh, we can do all these things, but to think about, we put creative and performance together. And, you know, then when we get hired, we can go into, we can do media buying and planning. We have social experts. We can do TV, you know, we can do blah, blah, blah. So it's more about what they get. You know, we put these two things together to build great brands. And, you know, it took a while to kind of develop that. And the hard simplifying your pitch is the hardest thing. And it's easy to do, which is crazy. It's like less is more, right? Simplifying your message. And we do it for clients day in and day out. You know, we get right to the heart of what they're trying to communicate and do it in the simplest, most consistent way we can. Doing it to yourself for whatever reason, I guess that's why brands hire agencies, because doing it for yourself is so much different. And it's so much harder, you know? So it took us longer to get there because we did on our own, yeah.
It's so funny you mentioned that, because we've had that recently with an advisor who, I guess our management team will sit down for 2 hours with once a quarter and just discuss these sort of things. And he literally said to me, like, what is the job to be done for you? Like, who is your, because at the end of the day, the end customer is the CMO, right? And what do they come to you for these different things? They know generally there's a pocket of performance that of, you know, let's say 50% of their budget goes to, and then a certain percentage to creative. And then what's this other thing that you can fulfill, which for us is something that is just not so much cool, but different, so to speak, particularly with the talent
side. Yeah, you're specialized.
I'm guilty of that as well. As like, I think everyone is you just talk about the services you offer, but people don't match the services. They just want the outcome. Like, what is the job that you're giving me?
You know? Yeah, I think the thing that you guys can say you do, and I could be wrong, but I think the thing you do is really build community.
Yeah.
You know, you build community for brands, which is different than planning what their positioning is going to be for the next 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, or selling. I mean, obviously you can drive sales for products and services, but it's much more that the value, I would say, is building that community, that base that they can continually, you know, talk to.
Yeah. And the margin,
which is worth a lot of value. Yeah.
The margin in the game of performance and sales is a lot tighter as well. So it's almost like, do you want to compete in that space? Yes, you should do it for clients who you currently have, but should you compete directly with the big players that their entire focus is performance?
Yeah.
So that was the big insight for me. You know, if you think about your experience so far as a founder, I'm always curious on next steps and where to go. For us as an agency, we've got past that 5 A's where you're doing anything for anyone, anytime, anywhere, any price, that usual shtick. And then you find your specialization. And then usually it's a bunch of services. And now it's a bunch of outcomes. And you get closer and closer to that thing. And we need to make our head count is small. It's 5 or 6 people. We need to make the jump to 25. And these sound like minuscule numbers in between the amount of people that you have, but I know speaking to other independent agency founders that it can happen a lot quicker when you go from like 25 to 100 is a lot quicker than 5 to 25.
There's definitely different levels of where you plateau.
Yeah.
It's like certain growth is easier than other size growth.
What mistakes do you think agency principals continually make when they're trying to go from that 10 staff range to 50 to 100 to 200? Is it not recognizing soon enough that plateau has happened?
No, because a lot of times you could plan all you want, but the universe is going to give you what it gives you sometimes, you know? So it's not so cut and dry. I think the mistake, and these are going to be things that you will have heard, but it's true. The leadership, the key leadership is kind of everything, and everything stems from that. And if you have someone, an amazing talent, amazing person, you have to keep that person at all costs, and you have to hire forward. You have to bring that person on and stretch a little bit to get that person, because there's key game changers that just blow your agency up. And while everyone is important at an agency, there is that 80-20 rule that like 20% are the game changers. And trying to identify, you know, your job as an owner is trying to identify as you start to grow who those game changers are that really will make all the difference.
Do you think those are department leads, or do you think they are just specific positions, i.e. creative directors? As an example,
I think they're usually, you know, the leader of a division or a department that will just grow it up. But it could be an incredibly talented creative person that you must have, or it could be, you know, as you start to hire like a new business person, that's incredibly important. Mm. Another thing that I always believe in is investing in, maybe when you get to the next size, maybe if you're like 15 or 20, investing in an outside PR firm.
Okay.
That will get press for you and your clients and the work that you do, like okay. In the trades,
yeah,
beyond the trades, because that pull sales mechanism of getting your name out there so that clients call you is going to save you a lot of time and money.
Yeah, that's definitely the next stage of our marketing for us, is less inbound contact, more emphasis on content that can result in outbound relationships, and particularly that PR component. I've always wondered that, because we've got big trade media here, Adweek, Umbrella. So you think it's more about the PR firms working with you to get that positioning in the trade media around like a recent account you've won or something like that?
Yeah. Or, you know, you write a piece on the power of TikTok,
yeah,
for brands, or building community for brands. And instead of it going just on your LinkedIn, they'll get it placed somewhere.
Yeah.
That, you know, a client might read and will give you a call, or they'll come up with strategies that you don't have time to think about. Of how to get your name out there. But investing in yourself and your business to get the word out there will really get the phone to ring.
Yeah. You mentioned before about leads of departments and things like that. I mean, obviously you have partners in the firm. It seems that most are typically specialists or focus on a certain area, as opposed to, you know, there's obviously partners who are things like operating officers as well. But in particular, I'm thinking about someone like Brendan, who is clearly the social influencer star at Mechanism. So, you know, in my mind, he's probably one of the smartest people in this space at the moment.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely a thought leader.
What have you learned from Brendan and other specialists like him in bringing them into the fold?
Yeah, well, back to my point of the keeping stars on your team. I had started working with Brendan he interned for me when I was.
That's right.
Yeah. At a different age, which is how we started. Yeah. And then he sort of worked with me for a large chunk of his career. And then he started his own social media agency called Epic Signal.
That's right.
And I had missed having that expertise in-house that I ended up convincing my partners for us to buy his firm and fold them into Mechanism. And so that's a very expensive lesson of like, you got to keep those stars.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when he left, I was like, yeah, okay. You know, maybe it's time. And then I realized lacking that specificity and that knowledge and that thought leadership was a ding for the agency. So I had to figure out a way to bring him back in. And, it cost me more money than making sure he stayed and keeping him happy.
You know? So was that your only, is that the only acquisition that you guys have made?
Yeah, that's the only one.
Wow.
Yeah.
There you go. Okay. So that is a good point, because I was reading this book, The Business of Expertise, and they're like, oh no, you should let people just fly the coop, go and do their own thing. Maybe they'll come back to you. And sort of, this is a lesson of no, actually. You should hold on to
this
person.
Well, I think, you know, 90% of those people, you can let them do that, but you got to identify that.
Yeah. Not Brennan.
Those key people that you have to have.
Yeah.
And make sure you know, give them a piece of the company, whatever you have to do to lock them in. Cause it's going to cost you a lot more in sweat and worry and stress and searching than it's worth, you know.
Before we get into rapid fire questions, I want to ask you about selling a leader. I know the firm was involved in the Biden Harris logo, but I don't know if you were involved in that, but obviously you've had experience
definitely.
With sort of center left organizations, campaign groups. It's fascinating to me because I know one day that area of politics and, you know, reading a lot of things like propaganda has always fascinated me. Like, how do you sell a person, particularly in the field of politics? So,
yeah,
you know, you've obviously had this cross-pollination from the ad game and the political game. How would you sell a leader if you were tasked with the next Democrat campaign? Let's say Biden gets his next 8 years and then you've got to pitch some, I don't know, Kamala or someone.
Yeah.
For the next term. How would you go about it?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'm not a political marketer.
Yeah. You think different field?
We did do the logo for the Biden Harris successful campaign, but we, I think it's all about, you know, consistency of message and having a point of view, and like all good brands, having a catchy handle is a game changer.
Yeah.
You know, Make America Great Again is pretty freaking memorable.
Very memorable.
You know what I mean? And it was ripped off. Reagan used it.
Yeah.
You know, and it was used before him. So it was repurposed, but I think the power of a tagline and a slogan can't be undervalued. And Democrats typically don't like doing that. They don't like having like one line or one thing they stand with. So that's one thing I would definitely do.
Yeah.
Consistency of message is important, and it's overlooked in that sphere, but it's important, you know?
It's really interesting. I've started watching this doco. Someone did a similar thing on YouTube. The channel was CCP Grey, but the doco is called How to Become a Tyrant. And it's just like the playbook of becoming a tyrant, and there's all these little cues that you see and around that politicians utilize, not to say that politicians are tyrants, but it's just really interesting to see how many things like slogans are so useful. And they talk to in this doco, what is the specific cognitive bias that is utilized in that case? So, you know, going to that science arm of your business, how does a cognitive bias fulfill something like a slogan? And slogans are brilliant. because a good slogan can condense an entire movement or idea into like a couple words.
Absolutely.
So yeah, it was very enlightening watching that in particular.
I mean, to me, there's three rules of marketing in general, and I would apply that to, you know, personal brand, politicians, political marketing, brands at large. And it's, you know, a simple message, taking something complex and making it simple.
Yeah.
It is consistency of message, but variety of where you show up, but you show up in the space correctly, but with a consistent message from the brand. And yeah, the third is where I was going on your business, but it's really involvement marketing. And how do you get the audience or the voter or your followers, how do you get that to be part of your marketing team? Mm. You know, how do you get that to extend your message farther than, community? And that to me is the trick of successful marketing campaigns.
Yeah, that is a tricky thing. How do you make it organic, like truly organic, and not just like contrived? That's literally the name of the game in this era, right?
Definitely.
All right, let's do some rapid fire questions to finish things off.
Okay, cool. I'm sending you a copy of my book, by the way.
Amazing. I would really appreciate that.
I'll send one for your wife / business partner.
Awesome.
You can read it in bed together.
Do you know what's so funny? It's like, because I read in bed every night. I read a lot of books. Because it's the only way that I can sort of calm down at night. I can't be on my phone or anything.
Yeah.
So I'll be sitting there reading. What have I read recently? It's called The Town and the Square or something like that. And it's about networks, and it came out sort of in the midst of that Cambridge Analytica thing.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So it talks a lot about networks and the impacts of those in society. And so I'll be sitting there reading this 500-page tome of like networks and shit like that. And she's sitting there just like looking at dogs and cats. And
oh my God.
it sort of shows that, you know, for us, very different personalities and how they work well together, both as a couple and as business owners. Because there's things that she can do that I could never do and vice versa. And it's so funny because I'll be reading. I guarantee if she had the book, like she'd probably get 10 pages in and she'd be like, can you just tell me what it's about?
Oh, can I listen to,
like, if it's the audio book, she could listen to the audio book for sure. All right. So rapid fire questions. Best purchase under $200.
So you know what a Theragun is?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. I have a Theragun. I work out a lot and I'm sore all the time and okay. I'm getting older. This thing is like a game changer. It does there's a Hypervolt, there's all those sort of massage guns.
Uh-huh.
But they actually do work. They're fantastic.
Okay, so talk to me about that, because it's called percussive therapy, I think. Like, why is this thing so good? Because I've heard a lot of people talking about this recently in the last year, let's say, and I'm tempted to buy one. Why should I buy one?
Do they have do you see them popping up over there?
Everywhere. Okay. I mean, it's all over social media, right? You can just buy it online.
Basically, it when your muscles are sore from working out, they get inflamed or your muscles break down. That's how they build back up, right?
Yeah.
And so a massage gun helps the healing process speed up because it basically directs blood flow, just like acupuncture or massage. Uh-huh. Like sports massage, it directs blood flow to the area of soreness,
yeah,
and reduces inflammation and lets the muscle basically get back to normal quicker.
Okay.
So for pain management, but also for a speedier recovery, they're incredibly useful.
Mm.
And it just feels good, like hitting yourself with a gun. Whatever sore.
Does it feel like you've had a massage? Like it's just a similar tension relief, right?
Yeah, it's similar, except you use it like maybe like 2 minutes in a certain area. It's very quick.
Okay. Wow. Right. Yeah. I've been sussing this one out for a while now. Theragun. Good. I like that. That's a good answer. Podcast, doco, or movie you've been watching lately?
So I watched the Bee Gees documentary on HBO. Have you seen it?
No. They're an Australian band as well.
I know. That's why it's relevant here.
Yeah.
But they were from Australia. They ended up basically moving to Miami. They recorded a couple albums in Miami and then ended up staying there basically. But they started in Australia, and that's where they first gained popularity. And I think it was Melbourne.
I think it was somewhere like regional that they originally started out. They would have gone to my father-in-law. He's 70, and there's a photo he's got in front of the big cathedral in Rome, the Basilica, and he looks like with his two friends like a Bee Gees cover. And he's always been obsessed with the Bee Gees.
They're so good.
Yeah, they're so good.
So I kind of slept on them for a long time.
Yeah, right.
And my girlfriend and I watched this documentary, and then we started listening to music all the time again. And they're so good. Actually, they were born on the Isle of Man.
That's right.
And then they lived in Manchester, and then they moved to
Australia.
Queensland.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah. And then Crib Island. I don't know where that is.
So you're a big Bee Gees fan.
Yeah. And the documentary basically showed how influential they were and the rise and fall of them, because they became known as like a disco band.
Uh-huh.
And then there's this whole movement in the US around disco sucks and like the end of disco, because it became too commercialized.
Yeah.
And then they sort of had a second career, which was songwriting for other bands, because no one wanted to hear from them again after the whole disco sucks era. And then they had another resurgence, and then there's only one of the brothers lived.
Yeah,
there's three Bee Gees, and then there's Andy Gibb. He died of a drug overdose. The other two died of, I think one had cancer, I can't remember. And then the main guy, Barry Gibb's, the only one that's still alive.
Yeah, and he's still got his Aussie accent too. They did a whole 60 Minutes thing on them recently. They've had a resurgence as well on TikTok. Like a few Bee Gees songs are like trending quite a lot.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, you're the TikTok expert, so that's
So
that's good insight.
It's so funny. Like I heard it the other, someone had mixed it, and I just went straight back to because we're in lockdown. I think I told you earlier. And on that, what's that main Bee Gees song? Bee Gees, everyone knows the song, Stayin' Alive. Yeah. And it looks like they're walking down a boardwalk, and I just forwarded it to our group chat with my father-in-law. I'm like, hey, I found Charles walking down the boardwalk. But yeah, that Stayin' Alive is trending massively at the moment. All right, last question for you. Quotes you live your life by or think about often?
Well, there's one that I really like, which is, do you know Tottenham Hotspurs?
Yep.
So they have this motto, this club motto, to dare is to do.
Okay.
Which I love. And to me, it's like, I always love things that are simple. To dare is to do is simple, right? It's five words. But to me, it's really the idea of always being courageous enough to do something, like the act of attempting or making the move or doing something, that's the act of in and of itself. Mm. And so if you're doing that, if you're taking that dead, if you're or dare, if you're being brave, if you're being courageous, that means you're doing something. And so I always kind of think about that and not being paralyzed, not having inaction, but always trying to make sure I'm courageous enough to try something.
And are you a Tottenham fan?
Not really, no.
Okay. Who's your EPL team then?
I like Manchester City.
Okay. I'm a Man United fan.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. I grew up in the era of David Beckham. So being a soccer fan, that was the team, right?
Yeah, he's amazing.
He's the king. Jason Harris, thank you so much for coming on. I know it's late over there. Where can people find you on the interwebs?
The soulfulart.com is my website where you can learn more about the book. And then you can find me at Jason_Harris on the socials.
On all socials?
On all socials. And then mechanism.com, MEKANISM.com is our agency's website.
I'll make sure we link all that.
Thanks, man.
But otherwise, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was a blast.
Thank you so much for checking out this episode. If you do like it, please subscribe. And of course, like if you're watching the YouTube video as well. We'd really appreciate that. You can also find our Clips channel in the description. For audio, if you're not already listening, you can search Uncommon on Pocket Casts, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts quite easily. For video, if you're not watching, you can search Uncommon on YouTube. And for behind the scenes takes and clips on social media, then definitely check out at Uncommon_show on Instagram. But otherwise, look, thanks so much for tuning in. And until next time, thanks for listening.